an hour of news in 15 minutes.
Weekdays at 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. It's the end of the news as you know it.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Our topic today is the forgotten women of the War on Terror. That is also the subtitle of my guest's book. She's Victoria Britton, journalist and former associate editor for The Guardian newspaper. And as a research associate for the London School of Economics, she traveled through conflict areas in Africa and Europe, investigating the impact of those conflicts on the women there. She's the author of several books, including Hidden Lives, Hidden Deaths, Death of Dignity, and this, her most recent, released just this year, Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. Welcome to KBOO, Victoria Britton.
Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to have you here with us. I spent the last few days reading your book and really very much enjoyed it. I felt like I actually was in the living rooms and kitchens and on some of those horrible trips to the prisons with these women. And so I really appreciate the, you know, it just felt like you were inside there with them through all this. And it was really a good way to read the book. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you for having that response. That's exactly what the women would like to hear, that non-Muslim women who have never really thought about what happened to women in the War on Terror would relate to them and let them know that the dehumanization they've suffered from gets broken when people actually think about them as individuals. So that's great.
Yes, and you do a really good job of letting us see that. And there were surprises for me along the way, so we'll talk about that as we get going. But I wondered if you could set the background, the larger world context in which what brought these women to the situation that they're in your book. Just a little bit to begin, because we really do want to focus on the individual women.
Yes. Okay, well, I will try to be brief, but it's extremely complex series of world events. I mean, one of the strands is that several of these families are Palestinians their families were moved out of Palestine in 1948 or 1967, and have then found uneasy homes in Jordan or other places in the Middle East. And from among these people, there were a number who, when the Cold War, if anybody remembers the Cold War, was on, and the Americans were decided to try to hit the Russians who were then occupying Afghanistan. The Americans brought many, many Muslim men from many countries, and a lot of the people in my book were among those families that traveled to Pakistan and Afghanistan in what they called a jihad against the Russians, or the Soviet Union.
Yes, so, and most of us are familiar with that history, if from nothing else, you know, movies that came out with Tom Hanks that talk about, you know, one of our congressmen who helped.
Oh, that's right, Charlie Wilson's War.
War, exactly.
Yeah,
and so these were families that went thinking that they were helping free a country from a world power that was attempting to take it over, which had invaded it, the Soviet Union.
Exactly. But what happened very suddenly was when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Russians left Afghanistan, the Americans and the Pakistanis, who had been the facilitators of much of that jihad, they didn't want those Arabs to be in those areas anymore. So many of those people tried to come back to their own countries, but there was a general strong feeling against them. And many of them ended up in getting a political asylum because they had been threatened with prison or had actually suffered prison in these countries like Libya, Egypt, Lebanon, and Jordan. They ended up getting political asylum in Britain. And the sort of paradoxical thing about these lives is that they live, those families, very happy lives in Britain, very quiet, brought up their children, and they lived like that for 10 years. But then when 9/11 happened, the British government, which was then led by Tony Blair, had a kind of roundup of all kinds of Muslims. And this was because the American and British governments were desperate to find out who was behind 9/11, and they allied themselves with the security services of many Arab countries.
And this was people, also when they, here in the United States, as many people know, approximately 1,200 Muslims here in America were rounded up in the first days after 9/11 and put in, some of them in some really despicable prisons. And many of them were later quickly deported. Most of them were released relatively quickly. But this was a terrible thing throughout the Muslim communities in the United States as well.
Yes, I think it's very much scarred the Muslim communities within the United States, which I discovered earlier this year when I was touring with my book. But in Britain, we had a different phenomenon. It was a much smaller group of people, men, and it was in fact about a dozen men. And they were held in a British prison for 2.5 years without any kind of charges until the highest court in the land, the House of Lords, said this was not okay, they had to be released. That then began a saga which lasted in some cases for more than 10 years of these men going in and out of prison, the government attempting to send them back to countries where they had been refugees from, and the court saying, no, you can't send people back to places where they'll be tortured.
And were these the men that when they were out of prison, they were on control orders?
Some were on control orders, which is a kind of house arrest of a fairly draconian sort, very similar to what the apartheid regime did in South Africa. They were not allowed to meet anybody who was not cleared by the security services. So the families began to have extremely isolated lives, including the children, with rules which will seem bizarre when I tell you. Things like the children were not allowed computers, so they were not able to do their homework. They were not allowed memory sticks. Their friends couldn't visit the house. The wives' friends couldn't visit the house.
Well, let's start talking about that through the women themselves then. You've done a good job of setting a context for our audience as a well-educated audience in general about the world affairs. So let's go ahead and talk about, I wanted to talk hear you talk about Saba. She was the wife of Jamil Albana.
Well, Saba is the chapter one of my novel.
Yes, she's the first one.
I mean, not my novel, my book. And in a sense, she is the genesis of the book. She and I became very, very close friends over this last 10 years. And it was through her that I met a lot of other people. But what happened to her was a microcosm of what I've just described. It's a Palestinian family. And her husband and her had, in fact, gone to Pakistan during the anti-Soviet jihad. But then when they lived in England, her husband didn't speak English. He found England difficult, and he decided to go to Africa with some other friends to try to start a peanut oil venture. And the four men who went to West Africa to try and start this peanut oil venture as a way of getting into business were arrested by Americans and taken first to Bagram and then Bagram in Afghanistan and then to Guantanamo. And this thing was like a bolt from the blue.
Well, yes, it would be pretty shocking to think your husband's gone off on a business trip. And I don't know, when did she hear he was taken?
She didn't hear immediately. And what was so puzzling was she never had any reason why he was arrested. And this is a theme that runs through almost all these families' difficulties in dealing with what either the British or the Americans did to their men. There was never any reason, and there was never any idea of when it would end.
And that's still going on in Guantanamo, and for some of the, well, obviously the families of those there.
Well, one of the women in my book is, in fact, the wife of somebody who is still in Guantanamo, Shaka Ama. I'm sure your listeners would have heard of him. He's the last man from Britain who is still in Guantanamo Bay. And this is someone who was cleared by the Bush administration twice, then cleared again by the Obama administration. The British government say they have asked for him, but mysteriously, he's still there, and nobody knows why.
I think the secrecy
behind the lack of justice that is really the leitmotif of almost all the stories I've written is one of the things that I think is so dangerous for my society and also for yours.
Yes, I agree. And I want to let people know I'm talking with Victoria Britton. We're talking about her recent book, Hidden Lives. I'm giving the wrong title. Sorry about that. Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. And we're talking about the lives of individual women who have been affected by U.S. and U.K. policies in the war on terror. With talk about Shaker Amir's wife, Zanira, and what the kind of torture of never knowing what's happening to your husband. At some point, the wives of those who were taken to Guantanamo, figure out that their husbands were there, and they began to hear of the horrors that happened on the way to Guantanamo. In Guantanamo, talk about how that affected, you know, different wives handled it differently. Talk about both Saba and Zanira.
Well, I would like to talk about Zanira a bit because given that her husband is still in Guantanamo, has been on this hunger strike that's lasted for 6 months, and has every possible reason to be released and isn't released. It's one of the saddest stories. Zanira, she has four children, a little girl, not so little now, and three boys. And her husband had been a charity worker in Afghanistan and had been building schools and digging wells. And by all accounts, he was a very dynamic, amusing, warm, fun person. Zanira was always very quiet. She is British. All her family are British. But her original family came from India.
And she, like most of these wives, really loved her husband. We think of, quote, arranged marriages as not involving that. But almost in every case you talked about, these people sought each other when they saw each other. And these were marriages of affection and deep, deep caring.
There was somebody who said that the play that I wrote about these women should have been called Love Never Dies, because you're right, the theme of how much they love their husbands and how much they've managed to keep these relations alive with almost no contact over years is one of the most moving and extraordinary things about all these women. But Zanira is one of those who has had several breakdowns when the stress just became too much. And she is a fragile young woman. But nonetheless, when she's in her good times, she's a great mom. She's brought up her children absolutely beautifully. But imagine having four children who last saw their dad when they were like 5 years old, and the youngest child has never seen his dad. Doesn't really have the concept of what is a dad. I mean, these are such incredibly difficult circumstances to bring up a family. And of course, because of the fear factor that you mentioned earlier on, many of these families have had to confront a lot of stigma and a lot of ostracism, even from other Muslims. So it has been a real trial of more than a decade now for many of these people.
So when we finish today, or at the end today, I want to get back to what we may be able to do to support Zanera in the form of, making protest about Shaker Amir. I think that we can all take some action to say, release this man. And there's been some evidence that this kind of activity can have an effect. Though I think it's been one of the more difficult things, and you talked about this in your book, Victoria Britton, that sometimes family members would take up these campaigns and, you know, really take themselves out of their normal kinds of roles if they were shy or not used to speaking in public. And already they stand out as different within the overall of Britain to campaign for their fathers or their sons and brothers, and then found they didn't work and nothing resulted in the end, or they were rearrested again. And that's also part of this funny kind of torture of this indefinite ongoing stigma attached to these people.
Yes, it is. It is very, very much part of the torture that they've lived through. And earlier on, you know, when what did we know? We always assumed that Guantanamo would end, you know.
Yeah, we thought he'd close it.
We thought it would all finish. And people did encourage some of the women and certainly some of the children to speak at amnesty meetings and such things. But the sense of failure and the huge disappointment that followed, I think, has been psychologically extremely difficult for people to cope with. And these days, those of us who campaign on these things always tell them they don't need to do it. It's our turn to do it for them. And I think it would be completely wonderful if your listeners also begin to put pressure on their congressmen to do demonstrations, to write letters, just to say that this is, that the holding of these people who've been cleared, it should not be what America is supposed to be like. And I think people are very mobilized, and particularly women. I'm sure you know that many of the Code Pink people did a lot of demonstrations outside the White House back in April when the hunger strikes really began to hit people's consciousness.
Yes, and there's been actions here as well.
But we've got absolutely nowhere. We have to keep going on these things.
Well, I agree with you. And let's go on and talk about, I want to talk about one other of the women in Britain, just because she's so, you wrote about her so well, and I felt like I got to know her family as well. And that's Hamda, wife of Mr. O'o. Talk about that bizarre thing, the anonymity that's forced upon them as well. Can you talk about her and how you first came to meet that family? And
yes, this is a Jordanian family. And when I first met Hamda, it was because a young man I slightly knew, or who'd read some of the things I'd written or heard me speak, asked me if I would come and visit this family where the father had been arrested suddenly. Nobody, again, of course, knew why. And then while he was in prison, he'd had a brain hemorrhage. There had been a request for bail from the hospital, but he'd been put back in the prison and had begun to lose his mind. So I went to visit this family just to see if I could understand this very strange story. And I met Hamda, who didn't at that time speak very much English. And she was surrounded by her five daughters, all of them very heavily veiled in black. And I listened to the story, and I thought, I'm never going to understand this. But I was always looking at her and looking in her eyes, and I was so appalled by the story, I started to go back to visit her. And over the months when he was held in prison or then in a secure mental hospital, we became close, although we didn't really speak each other's language. I mean, I speak halting Arabic, and she's speaking halting English. But there were always the girls with us. And I came to love this family for their warmth and their amazing support to each other. The girls' husbands, the little children, everybody was focused on the grandfather who was in the hospital. And finally, he was released, and a British judge ordered his deportation to Jordan should be dropped on the grounds that his health was so frail, it was completely impossible to imagine you could have uprooted him from this nest of safety and warmth that Hamda had made.
Well, the thought that he could be dangerous given his physical condition and a wheelchair, et cetera, is incredible. And you know, you talked about the mothers and daughters, and that was a characteristic you saw among Palestinian women, I believe you said. And I have a friend who's married to a Palestinian man, and she's told me about her family with him. And I've seen pictures of them together, and I began to imagine them together, these families, as you saw them, because I could see the gathering and how warm and familial that is, a real characteristic of that culture that we're not really told much about when we're told anything about Muslim cultures here.
No, of course that's true. And what I think so often about many of my friends, some in the book and others who didn't make it into the book, is that actually these women are role models, that in Western societies there are so many family problems, so many problems with teenagers and with children to do with consumerism, to do with new technology and so on. And here I discovered another world where the strength of the women and the rules of their faith have made a different kind of world. And it's one that I feel extremely privileged to have been allowed to become part of.
And I want to say really clearly, all of these women had no urge to be in any way violent to any of the cultures around them, and by and large neither did most of their men. You know, we don't have all that much more time, and I do want to get on to talking about the women that you met here in the United States. So let's do that. I'm talking again with Victoria Britton. We're talking about her recent book, Shadow Lives: The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. So you got to know some women here in the United States who are either daughters or sisters of men who have been taken up in this war on terror. Can you talk a little bit about them? And also, it seemed to me that in this case, that some of the men were picked because they were articulate and good spokesmen, not because they even had anything to do with a terrorist agenda. So if you could talk about those women
I would like to talk about a couple of those women. Of course, I don't know them as intimately as I know my friends here who I've been living with all this time. But I have talked with them a lot and come to respect them very much by what they have done to try to successfully support their fathers. And the two cases I would pick out, and maybe your readers want to Google them and look a bit more for the history. One is Noor El Ashi, whose husband is in the kind of iconic case, war on terror case in the United States, and it's called the Holy Land Foundation case.
Mm-hmm.
And Noor's father and his brothers were very successful businessmen in America. And they ran the biggest and most successful Muslim charity in America. And it was a charity which gave to all kinds of people with different needs, including, for instance, people in Hurricane Katrina. But it also gave money to orphanages and women's groups in Gaza. And because the Hamas organization, which won the elections in Gaza, was designated as a terrorist organization by the United States government, this giving of aid to children and to women was designated as what's called material support to terrorism. And the case against them was so shabby and so flimsy that in the first, there was a court case which was completely thrown out. The jury did not believe that there was any terrorism involved. There was a second hearing in which secret evidence was brought. And it's well worth having a look at what's been written about this case, because it's so extraordinary. When I speak about it here to lawyers' groups and things, which I sometimes do, people are completely amazed that somebody can be put away like Noor's father for 65 years for running a successful charity. Now, Noor has, and her lawyers, have done a lot of speaking tours in America, and maybe some of your listeners may have heard her speak. But you can also look at her on YouTube and see her lawyer, also John Klein.
And that's Noor Al. Spell her name for people, her last name.
Elashi.
Okay, good.
But if you put Holy Land Foundation into Google, the story is very, very, very well told and many times over.
Well, and we had a wing of a similar case here in Portland, the Al Haramain case. And they did attempt to and spent many years and have only stopped trying to prosecute. Pete Seda is his American name, who ran a small wing of that charity down in Ashland. And they finally had a federal judge ruled that all they had on him was a small tax fraud case and that they had grossly overreached. And the tax fraud was really an accountant, a typo error. But that man has spent at least 10 years going through similar hardships as those from the Holy Land Foundation. And he has family as well.
I mean, one of the things that struck me very much when I was in America earlier this year and in the years I've been working on this is how American lawyers like the Center for Constitutional Rights, like Nancy Hollander, big human rights lawyers in America, have been absolutely open critical of a system which they say does not give correct judicial hearings to Muslims in America since 9/11. Very, very categorical about that. And as I say, the cases that I've studied, again, I found, like my friends in Britain, these very dignified young women doing a very American seeming to me, doing everything they can to support their mothers and their fathers in these long, long...
And many of them, like the women in Britain, are going ahead and getting their education while they're fighting these campaigns, while they're struggling to keep their families together. They're getting degrees. Their education is highly valued among almost all the women that you wrote about and within their families, and that's for both boys and girls. And many of them have been in college at the same time, and so they've lived almost double lives. Can you talk about the difficulty that the young women in America have had with that sort of double life feeling?
Yes, I'd like to talk particularly about a young woman called Mariam.
And I'm told I have 2 minutes, and I'll give them
Mariam
all to you
Abu
about
Ali.
Mariam.
It's another one that you can look at on the internet. And again, it's an example of a very brave, isolated young woman who has done everything to support her brother, who in a shocking, shocking case was put away for life. And he's just a young student. And Mariam is his big support. And she has kept herself going through college with a job in circumstances which make any of us feel completely humble. So do look at some of these.
Yes, and the jail circumstances here are actually harsher than in Britain. In Britain, the families could receive calls from their loved one once a day. Here, it's once a month for 15 minutes and only one family member. And they're often moved from prison to prison, so families can't get to them without expensive flights. I think we're going to have to leave it there. I've been speaking with Victoria Britton, wonderful author of Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. You can Google these women, but I recommend you get the book. It's not hard to read. It's easy to read. And if you like to learn about people, you really will feel that you have. Thank you so much for joining us today on KABU, Victoria.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure to speak to you, Linda.
Yes, well, thank you. And I want to thank our engineer today, Rock, for all of his great work. And I want to let you know that the next time you'll hear me on A Deeper Look will be October 10th as we kick off our fall membership drive here at KABU. I'm very excited for that drive. We always need the money to keep things going. Please tune in for that show, and please renew your membership or become a new member. Thanks again for listening to KBOO and A Deeper Look.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. Just a minute now before 10 o'clock. And coming up this morning, we've got in about 15 minutes, join us for Flashpoints, internationally celebrated writer and political analyst Michael Parenti on his new memoir, Waiting for Yesterday. Also on Flashpoints, Aurora Levin Morales talks about her new book, Kindling, Writings on the Body. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach interviews Katie Schultz about her new book, Flashes of War, which captures personal moments of fear, introspection, confusion, and valor in one collection spanning nations and perspectives. At 11:30 today, the film show presents a freewheeling conversation with former Portlander Penny Allen, who helped kickstart Portland's independent film scene in the 1970s. In addition to Oregon film history, we'll be discussing her newest feature, Late for My Mother's Funeral, which screens at the Northwest Film Center on December 16th. That's all coming up this morning. Stick around. Up next, it is Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, September 26, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. It's a media morning, as it turns out. We're going to be speaking later in the program with Maurice Carney, the executive director